Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today we're going to talk about the new IBR plan that so many of you are interested in hearing about and why it might be delayed, why it might not be available as we were thinking it would be by July 2023. It might be late 2023 or even into July 2024. So we're going to talk about that new IBR plan, and we are also going to talk about a couple other hot developments right now with student loan cancellation lawsuits, efforts trying to block Biden's student loan cancellation. We're going to talk about some new strategies that are probably coming down the pipeline based off of some new announcements about loan rules that probably will take effect in July 2023. And we're going to take some listener questions. Let's start off with the listener questions, and then we'll get into the meat of today's show. The first question we've got today is from Lewis.
Good evening. My question is, as of the moment, I have commercially held FFELL loans. However, I consolidated back in 2006. So the question is, due to the president's announcement today, do I still qualify for the student loan cancellation? Thank you. Look forward to hearing back from you.
The big issue here is President Biden on September 29th announced that commercially held FFEL loans would not qualify for the student loan cancellation plan. Why did he do that? The reason is there's these things called commercially held FFEL loans that are basically owned by investors, and the interest income is guaranteed by the government. This type of loan is owned by different kinds of investors, you know, such as Nelnet, Navient, but also pension funds, right? And so some Republican-led states that have pension funds that own some of these investments sued, saying that there was an incentive for borrowers to consolidate these FFEL commercial loans, and that therefore impaired their investment and gave them standing to try to block student loan cancellation. So Department of Education realized this, that this was the easiest path for somebody to sue to block President Biden's student loan cancellation plan. So they abruptly cut out people from being able to benefit from student loan cancellation with this type of loan on September 29th, which is the same day that the GOP-led states filed a lawsuit to block student loan cancellation. So this was all done to preserve the majority of the cancellation plan versus intentionally trying to limit folks' benefits. I think it's very clear the Biden administration would want to give out as aggressive benefits as possible to as many people as possible, but that team also wants to make sure that the cancellation plan doesn't get torpedoed. And the best way to stop it from being torpedoed is to stop someone from having standing to block it. Why does the standing question matter? It's basically because it very much seems to me that the Biden administration knows that this probably doesn't survive a challenge if the merits of the case are looked at with the composition of the courts, right? The Supreme Court's a 6-3 conservative majority. It's pretty clear that a conservative court is not going to believe that a law that was primarily intended to help military folks being deployed during a time of war in 2003, the HEROES Act, that is allowing the president and Department of Ed to have flexibility on student loans in times of national emergency, a conservative court would never agree that that law gives the power of the president to cancel $400 billion for almost all student loan borrowers, right? 40 million out of 42 or 43 million. The strategy legally the Biden administration is doing is whack-a-mole on standing. So if you can prevent anyone from having standing, which means that they're showing that an economic injury, that would prevent somebody from having the ability to challenge the lawsuit. If the lawsuit does get challenged by someone who successfully proves standing, then that cancellation plan is in big trouble. So in terms of the person's question, this person said they consolidated in 2006. Does this mean they're blocked from having the cancellation? Probably, yes, it does. And the reason for that is if you consolidated in 2006, you probably did not consolidate to a direct consolidated loan. You probably consolidated to an FFEL consolidation loan. And oftentimes, these loans are still commercially held FFEL loans. So for this person, yes, it might be too late to get the cancellation. What I would say is this, though. If you consolidated in 2006, presumably you've been making payments since then. You know, 2006 to 2022, let's see, what is that, like 16 years of payment credit, right? So if you've got 16 years of payment credit, if these loans are from undergrad, you're only 4 years away from having the whole thing forgiven through an income-driven repayment plan like Repay. If those loans are partly some loans from graduate school, then that would be a 25-year period until forgiveness. So then you'd be 9 years away from forgiveness. So even though this person might not qualify for cancellation, we might be overlooking that a much bigger benefit could be there if the person owes a lot more than $20,000, right? There might be a much bigger benefit that could happen if this person consolidated his loans into a direct consolidation loan before May 1st, which is the deadline for the IDR waiver consolidation. So good question. Let's do another listener question.
Hello, Travis. I'd like to thank you and your team for listening to my message and providing very valuable information. I am currently going for PSLF. I'm currently 4 years in as of now. I have submitted a form to Mohela to see if I have any other payments that relate in the past or anything that can give me more payments. But as of now, I am 4 years in. Also, I would qualify for the 20K because back in the day, I did get a Pell Grant that will qualify for me the 20K forgiveness. But I'm worried about being taxed on this 20K. I live in Indiana, and I believe I read that Indiana is one of seven states that plans on taxing on this forgiveness. Do you believe that I should apply to this 20K and possibly be taxed at the state level? I believe I read on the studentaid.gov website that it won't be taxed at the federal level. Now, the 20K would not really put a dent in my loans at all. I have a significant amount of loans and it will reduce some, but really it won't help much. So my question is for you, should I apply for the 20K and possibly get taxed or not and just continue to go on with PSLF and not do the forgiveness? Thanks for listening to my message. I appreciate any advice you give.
Wow, what an interesting question. I would not apply. I would opt out. The reason for that is in the states that tax student loan forgiveness, they're not going to tax PSLF for the most part. If you can be in a state where you're not going to get taxed on PSLF, and one of the key parts of this listener's question or context was that the 20K would not put a dent in her balance. The 20K is not going to make a difference. Like, you're still going for forgiveness anyway, no matter what, be it the 10-year or the 20-year forgiveness. So you're still going for forgiveness anyway. So if that's the case, yeah, you could get that 20K canceled, but then you'd owe $1,000 in taxes. And if that was forgiven via PSLF, you wouldn't owe that $1,000. Another thing that I would say is, you know, you do have until, I believe it's December 2023 to get the 20K cancellation in terms of applying for it. So there's no rush necessarily in applying for this. If they have your income on file, they might process it automatically, but they're supposed to let you know and notify you if you do want to opt out to tell you that you're one of these people that would get it automatically. I would say that the answer to this question is kind of twofold. You know, if you are one of these people that 20K cancellation would leave you with like 10 or 20 left because that would represent a lot of your balance, you know, I mean, I would sort of take the bird in the hand. But if you've got a lot of debt, six figures, and you're getting 20K canceled and it doesn't amount to much, I would just double check that your state does not tax PSLF, right? And I'm pretty sure Indiana doesn't, but, you know, just doing your due diligence, I would just double check. I know North Carolina does not tax PSLF, but it does tax student loan cancellation via the relief plan, right? So you would just double check with a tax professional or just doing some quick Google research. Hey, confirming Indiana does not tax PSLF, which I don't think it does, but double check. And if it did tax the relief, but not the PSLF, I would opt out of it. That sounds crazy, but that's what I would do simply because it would just raise extra costs for you. And at the end of the day, the whole point is to pay as little as possible holistically on your student loans, even if it doesn't feel great. So that's what I would recommend, even though it's kind of a awkward situation. Luckily, there's only four states in the country that do tax student loan relief, and it's not the largest states, right? So that's good. And a lot of the states that there's question marks on are going to be passing bills. Like, for example, there's some question marks as to California, if it would be taxable. That kind of a state's going to pass a law to make sure it's not taxable. You know, it's really kind of a pretty niche issue. Doesn't apply to a whole lot of people, but it does apply to some. So thanks so much for bringing up that question. Now let's take one more listener question.
Hey, Travis. First of all, thank you to you and the team, and I want to say your little one is in our thoughts and prayers. I'm a married medical student, and I will graduate school with approximately $360K in debt. My wife is in her final year of studies, and she has no student loan debt. If she were to return to the financial aid office at her school and take out loans for this current semester, would those loans be eligible for $20K in cancellation? She has received a Pell Grant in the past. Thanks.
So, yeah, I mean, the loans have to be taken out after July 2022 to be eligible for the cancellation. So if she hasn't already taken out the loans, then they're not eligible for cancellation. So that's a pretty straightforward one. One point I would say is a lot of people don't realize how, you know, effectively when you have one spouse who's got a lot of debt, like if another spouse wanted to go back to school and take out a lot of debt, it's almost like free money, or at least it can be. So one thing I wish people would do is reach out to us before they graduate, like before they borrow for loans, because we could really help people save tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, just planning on the front end, doing things the smartest way possible. What I mean by this is, like, let's say this individual spouse wanted to go back to school for, I'm just going to pick something, right? Nurse practitioner school or something like that. Say it's a four-year program, probably going to result in PSLF. You could do a whole lot of stuff where that couple would be able to file jointly instead of separately, and that couple would be able to, you know, jointly pursue PSLF together instead of one person pursue it, right? And so the extra marginal cost is really quite low when somebody owes a lot of debt and is already going for loan forgiveness. So there's all kinds of cool stuff you can do. You know, another mistake I see families make is when you only take out money for tuition. I can't tell you how many people I've run into that are going for forgiveness, but they only took out money for tuition because they had enough money saved up to cover living expenses, or they used one spouse's salary income to cover their living expenses while the other spouse was in school, but they didn't have enough money to cover tuition, so the other spouse borrowed to cover tuition. So that's a huge mistake. If you've got a loan program that's forgiving loans for a lot of people out there, depending on the math of what you borrow, then a massive mistake is not to take out 20, 30, 40K a year for living expenses, depending on how large your family is and what the cost of attendance budget would allow, because that's free money. So effectively, you know, a family that's got, you know, one or two kids and, you know, the other spouse works and the other spouse is in school, that doesn't max out on the cost of attendance budget that's going for PSLF or 20-year pay forgiveness, that person's leaving 40K per year on the table. And this is going to become a much bigger problem when the new IBR plan comes out, because in prior years, this has really only applied to, you know, graduate students that have been able to take out a lot of money, that are taking out really large amounts, like they're going to be more collectively than their income and debt. But when you're able to pay 5% of your income with the 225% poverty line deduction, people that are in school for undergrad degrees could really benefit a lot from taking out the max amount of loans. And so people that are taking out 20K instead of 40K, you know, are kind of screwing themselves over. So this is kind of one of the big problems long term. It's going to result in, really, frankly, accelerated inflation in higher education, right? As if you have zero marginal cost, prices will go up because people with the incentive to capture that revenue are going to capture it. And that's the schools. If the schools figure out, hey, there's no difference between somebody borrowing 20 and 40, then they're going to make sure that people borrow 40. That's just, you know, reality. And why have people not done that more so for graduate school yet? Well, there was all this doubt about the PSLF program. There was so much thought that that wasn't going to happen. A lot of popular personal finance talking heads really attacked the PSLF program, said it's, you know, you're betting your future on the government. And there was sometimes sort of like a kind of almost like a political angle on it. Like, you need to pay your loans back. You need to keep your costs low. Frankly, you do need to keep your costs low if that's what the system rewards and allows and kind of incentivizes. But if you have a system that is really so heavily tilted towards going for loan forgiveness, it's kind of like making a suboptimal decision on Social Security or Medicare, or not paying attention to marginal tax rates in terms of how many hours you work. A lot of people don't realize this. This is kind of an interesting point. The fifth day a week that you work, you're earning usually a lot less money than the first and second day you work in a week. And the reason is because of marginal tax rates, you know, meaning that, you know, your first $20,000 you earn might be taxed at 10%, and then the last $20,000 you earn might be taxed at 35%, just because of how marginal tax rates work. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that, and they're overworked and burdened and stressed out, and they feel like they don't have options. But you have actually a lot of options if you just recognized what our systems encourage and being willing to step up and take advantage of what the incentives are. Those are some thoughts, is be smart about just taking out financial aid when you're doing it for yourself or your family or your spouse. And then for this individual's circumstance, you know, you're not going to be able to take out the 20K and get it canceled, unfortunately. But that person is a doctor in training, you know, in residency, right? So we're going to talk a little bit about some strategies that might apply to that listener later in today's show. But I just thought I would give some background because it's one of the most common mistakes that we see with a lot of our consult clients on the back end. You know, how much more you could have done differently if you'd known about all the different loan strategies, you know, on the front end. So obviously there's a lot going on right now with student loans. We would love to get some more listener questions. You can ask your own question at studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. So if you go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, you can type it into your browser. You can use your mobile phone and just speak into it for like 30 seconds to a minute. Ask your question. We'll probably feature it on a show if you do that. Now I want to talk about the new IBR plan potentially being delayed and why. We've been kind of expecting the Biden IDR plan would be available in July of 2023. There's some situations that have developed that now I think it might be eligible in 2024 July. Maybe at the end of 2023, we'll talk about some details as to why. The deal with this new plan is this is something where the Biden administration can really turn the screws if they want to. If they want to deliver a lot of relief without any kind of potential GOP challenges in the legal front, this new IDR plan is a way they could do that. And so they are trying to tackle interest being high. They're trying to tackle the payment amounts. They're trying to tackle inflation by reducing people's payments, by increasing the amount that they can deduct before they take anything. They're lowering the percent of income that somebody has to pay for undergrad loans. They're shortening the time till forgiveness for a lot of people. They are really backing the truck up with this. The concern is if you do something so aggressive via executive action that a future Republican White House could come along and undo all this and eliminate this plan, and they could actually go farther. They could actually take away the repay and the pay plan for new borrowers. So we do think that the repay and the pay plan, you know, are in people's promissory notes, and if a plan is in your promissory note, that would be a pretty difficult argument to make that that could be taken away from you. So that's always operationally what we've thought about, and I think that that's accurate. So if you have a consolidation loan or you took out loans after the repay and pay plan came into being, you will see the repay and the pay and, you know, plans in your promissory note. So that means they're pretty safe. For people that are wanting the new the Biden IBR plan in their promissory note, you know, you might consolidate depending on what the rules are and get access to that way, you know, as well. So the thought is this new IBR plan, you know, why would it be delayed? What's going on as to why it might get pushed out? The Department of Education's got to release the rules for a new IBR plan by November 1st for it to take effect the following July. That's just the rules. And they have not done that. They've not gotten the detailed regulations for the IBR plan released, and they didn't do it by November 1st. What that probably means is that they're going to come out with that new IBR plan details, and I kind of wonder a couple things. I wonder if all of the resources at Department of Ed and the White House that work on education are have been devoted to this student loan cancellation plan, which is probably the most likely thing, and everybody's attention has been focused on accomplishing this cancellation plan, and therefore people are not paying attention at all to other things that carefully. So that's one thought, is that the resources weren't there to get this out by November 1st. Another thought is they're using this new IBR plan as a poker chip, and they're wanting to see if cancellation goes through or not. If cancellation does go through, then this new IBR plan is a little bit lower priority because the people that are remaining, there's going to be a lot fewer borrowers remaining when the cancellation takes into effect. And so you probably don't necessarily need to be extra aggressive with this new IBR plan compared to what you've already said in public that you're going to do. I do think they're obviously going to do what they're already talking about in public, but there's a chance that they could go even more aggressive with this plan. And when might they do that? It would be if cancellation got blocked. They might say, hey, let's go even harder on this new IBR plan because we were blocked with cancellation. So let's increase the poverty line deduction to 300%, or let's make the payment 5% for everyone, right? There's different things that they might try to do if they get blocked in court on the cancellation. And I wonder if that's the reason they're delaying the release of the IBR plan and why that might get delayed a little bit in terms of implementation. Now, the real issue here, if you have this plan delayed, when would it be available? Well, the repay plan got availability in December 2016, I think. No, sorry, maybe December 2015. This is, you know, difficult off the top of my head to remember the exact date, but it did come into being kind of at a non-traditional time of year. And I think they just used some special flexibilities to get it live. Maybe I would kind of anticipate that this new plan for Biden's IBR plan might be available by the end of 2023 if they use some sort of tricky legal maneuvering. So that's possible, but it's also possible it gets pushed into July 2024. If it came out in July 2024, remember the presidential election's in November 2024. So if a Republican were to win that election, I think this new IBR plan would be toast. I think that they would do negotiated rulemaking right away. I think that they would seek to be very aggressive in the sense that, you know, in the same way that Democrats have been aggressive through executive action on student loans, you would see the opposite of that, where Republicans would try to peel back the pay plan, the repay plan, the Biden IBR plan through negotiated rulemaking, and they would have to do it for new borrowers only. And that wouldn't be able to happen. That change would not be able to happen if you think about the calendar, right? A new Republican president, if the Republican were to win 2024, would not come into the White House until 2025. They would have to publish the rules by November 2025 for them to take it into effect July 2026. So if they did pull back a lot of these plans for new borrowers only, you know, people that are taking out loans that might want access to that Biden IBR plan, that maybe you could consolidate to get that plan in your promissory note, for example. So there's all kinds of planning opportunities around these next few years of chaos that we're expecting that you'll be able to take advantage of. The new IBR plan is a little bit less critical to some people out there because a lot of folks are not going to have to recertify their payment until 2024, right? If we look at when people last recertify their payments, you know, a whole lot of people don't have to recertify, you know, or a lot of people recertify, you know, in February, March. We see a lot of those types of dates. Those folks, instead of recertifying in 2023, you're recertifying in like March 2024 now. So nobody's going to have to recertify their income prior to, let's see, July 2023, right? And if your date falls before July 2023, that date gets kicked out to 2024 in terms of your recertification date. Just as an example, you know, if your recertification date's March 15th, 2023, your new recertification date is March 2024. So what that means is your payment is probably a lot lower than it would be if you had to recertify your income, particularly for folks in, you know, higher earning specialties like, you know, medicine, law, dentistry, in some cases for people that do residency programs. A lot of like newer grads, maybe you recertified last when you were, you know, making income for half the year because you graduated in July or August and took your job in September. So your payment's based off of an income year that was very short. So a whole lot of people will have very low payments until late 2023 anyway. And so that's one reason why that new plan is a little bit less critical. I do see some different situations though, too, where if people's incomes like haven't soared, in many cases, their payments could actually be brought down significantly by updating people's family size. So I had this case the other day where a nonprofit employee made about the same amount of income the past like 4 or 5 years, but the difference is he was a family size of maybe like 2 the last time he recertified his income in 2019. And going into 2023, he's going to have a family size of 5 because he had 3 kids during the pause. Kind of amazing. I mean, in terms of how long this pause has lasted, if he recertifies his income, his payment would drop from, I think, $200 a month to $0 a month under existing repayment plans because his family size has grown so much. So there are a lot of considerations that are going to be made. I mean, like, I think that there's no doubt in my mind that our consult team is going to be able to help people just figure out what plan to be on and when to certify and how and when to switch to the new plans that come out. That's something that's definitely going to pay for the consult fee in 9 times out of 10, at least. There's other strategies that I want to talk about too today. So with this IBR plan being delayed, some of the things that probably will not be delayed are new rules in terms of interest capitalization, deferment forbearance being able to count for PSLF in some cases, as well as broader PSLF eligibility rules. So a couple things in particular that are meaningful. Deferment and forbearance can now count in certain cases for PSLF. So if you're a resident, you will now have the ability to request a deferment instead of having to be in an income-based plan, and that deferment can now count for PSLF. So you can request basically residency deferment, And starting in July 2023 is what we're expecting, that deferment can count for PSLF. So instead of having to pay $300 a month, you could pay zero a month and have that count for PSLF. The other thing that matters is interest capitalization now is not going to happen when exiting a grace period or exiting forbearance or changing repayment plans, coming off of the repay or the pay plan. The only time interest will capitalize is if you're exiting the IBR plan or if you are consolidating your loans, for example. Those are the primary things that would happen. So one thing that we're going to have to deal with is if you're finishing medical school, you can consolidate and have your repayment period start 2 months after graduation and start your PSLF credit immediately, or you can wait for that 6 month grace period to be in effect. And the 6 month grace period presumably would not count to PSLF. And so you would have to decide, do I capitalize my interest to get an extra, you know, cause it happens and you basically start repayment after 2 months instead of 6 months when you consolidate. So you have 4 extra months of PSLF. So the question is getting 4 extra months of PSLF worth capitalizing your interest? That's a math question that we can help people figure out when the rules change. Another thing that is relevant is the new IBR plan that Biden's coming out with is going to have interest subsidies where whatever your required payment is, the interest above that is fully covered 100% by the government. So if your required payment is $100 a month and your interest is $1,000 a month, the government would pay the $900 net number above the $100 a month you're required to pay. So that's an enormous interest subsidy that you would get in an IBR plan that you would not get if you were in deferment. That's also going to be really interesting. So for residents and fellows out there, how much do you want to hedge your bets? Do you want to get that interest subsidy for a pretty low cost just in case you go private practice? Or would you prefer to go all out for PSLF and go for that deferment strategy? If you do go for the deferment strategy, the question there is if you defer instead and just take advantage of that grace period and you wait for the 6 months grace period to be over with, that's going to extend your PSLF clock by 4 months as an attending. So presumably if you're an attending, you'd have to pay payments like $2,000-$3,000 a month. So the question is as an attending, would you want to pay an extra $2,000 a month for 4 months? That's $8,000 total, you know, in exchange for being able to defer your loans and not making any payments in residency and having that extra time clock last, you know, for longer because you're doing the 6 months grace period instead of consolidating and getting started on payments pretty much right away. In past years, because capitalization would happen no matter what, and because deferment forbearance did not count for PSLF, the advice for some residents that were single was pretty straightforward. It was basically like, well, just consolidate and get it on repay. That's what people would all tell people. Oh, you don't need a student loan plan. Just consolidate and get it on repay. You know, for some people, that was okay. A lot of residents and fellows are married, and that makes it really complicated. And a lot of residents or fellows are, you know, wondering if they should go for, you know, like if they're married, the question is they're planning to get married during training. It's like, do you be on the pay plan, give up the interest subsidies so you can preserve the ability to file separate? Do you sign up for repay so you can get the subsidies and then change to the pay plan at some point? So a lot of, I would say, our residency fellow type of consults prior to these new rule changes were mostly for probably married folks. Now with these new rules, the planning opportunities are significantly more, where like a resident or fellow could easily save a couple to a few thousand dollars a year and future and current payments in many cases. And so that's just going to raise the ROI from getting a plan if you're a dental or veterinary or medical resident or fellow. Also, if you are a law clerk or something like that, that would also be a really relevant situation to discuss the new rules because they're complicated, right? Speaking of being complicated, there is indications that the Department of Ed is going to expand PSLF eligibility to cover people working at organizations that don't qualify for PSLF because the people are forced to work in that capacity because of state laws. So in the new PSLF rules, they specifically cited physicians in California and Texas that can't qualify for PSLF because of state laws, and that they said specifically that that group of people would be included in the new PSLF rules. So I'm not sure how they're going to do this, but what that's really stating, right, is what's the most common example that always pops up. It's Kaiser Permanente physicians in California and Texas, but especially in California, have people come up in that regard all the time. NPs and PAs possibly as well, nurses possibly as well. A lot of these folks are employed by for-profit groups, but they're employed that way because state laws prohibit direct employment of certain medical professionals by not-for-profit hospitals. And so in California, previously, the only PSLF eligible physicians we'd run into would be like university hospital unemployed physicians. So like if you worked at UCLA or USC hospital, or if you were working for the VA, for example, or like a community hospital, like nonprofit or something. Whereas, you know, obviously if you're in, you know, Massachusetts, you know, basically every hospital or New York, right? Almost every hospital is not-for-profit. And so virtually all physicians in those states qualify. And then there's states like, you know, maybe Tennessee where you have HCA, which is a for-profit hospital where, you know, the state law does not require physicians to be employed by for-profits. And so some thoughts there are that physicians in like California might get access to PSLF, whereas physicians working at a for-profit group in Tennessee that's HCA would not get access to PSLF because state law does not prohibit them from working, you know, with a not-for-profit hospital. So these laws are going to be really complicated. A lot of people kind of panicked and reached out before the PSLF waiver expired, and they were like, oh my gosh, Travis, do I need to apply for the PSLF waiver right now with my old Kaiser employment, and Kaiser's not willing to sign the paperwork for me? What can I do? Well, the issue is this is forward-looking, right? They can't go back in time and say the rules from the past, or we're going to change them with rules from the future. We can only change rules going forward. So what would help is if somebody tried to get credit for, you know, the PSLF waiver for like residency and fellowship that could have counted. That's legit. That counts. You're not going to get credit though for for-profit employment like at a Kaiser until after July 2023 if that's when they change the rules, right? So a perfect kind of example is somebody, let's say somebody is a like a orthopedic surgeon at Kaiser, right? And they did a 5-year or, you know, let's just say 6-year training period with residency and fellowship. So 6 years total, maybe they had the wrong kind of loans. By the way, you can still get access to PSLF in some cases, PSLF waiver in some cases if you consolidate by May 1. This particular example is really tricky because you, under the IDR waiver, to get the PSLF waiver benefits, you now have to be employed by a not-for-profit organization when they make the adjustment. So since these rules are not changing until July 2023, you know, you probably would not be able to get credit for past payments if you consolidated after November 1st and before May 1st. This is just ridiculously complicated, right? And why is it so ridiculously complicated? It's because the White House can't get Congress to agree on what reforms should look like. If Congress was the one that wrote these bills, they could get around all this. It'd be so easy. But the White House is doing it, which means they have to get around statutes. They have to get around legal challenges. They have to tailor things. They have to make things that can survive legal challenges as well as potentially future administrations. That's why things are just kind of so complicated. But what I would do is if I was this orthopedic surgeon at Kaiser, I would try to get credit for my training. And then I would realize that, you know, if my employer is going to become a qualifying employer for PSLF after July 2023, there might be some argument as to intentionally doing a forbearance because you're not going to get credit until the thing becomes a not-for-profit employer. And so you might strategically enter a forbearance instead of make payments on something that would not count to PSLF. You might strategically keep payments going too if your recertification date is going to have you recertify income in 2024 because maybe your payment's still $400 a month from certifying your income last in 2019 when you're still in training. And maybe that's the smarter decision instead of having to re-up your IBR payment at $4,000 or $5,000 a month. All kinds of planning opportunities out there for people that are working for for-profit employers technically that also really actually work at not-for-profit employers, specifically in these large states like California and Texas. And that does apply to a lot of people. So I've seen some real disaster stories from employer groups like Kaiser. One case in particular, somebody had hundreds of thousands of loans that they did a loan repayment assistance program with. Like the employer would cover 6 figures of loan payments if they worked at that hospital for a certain number of years. And what's so nuts is now those loans could have been eligible for PSLF, but because the employer paid them off already, this person was wanting to go work at a different employer. But then they owe the original group. So it just sort of shows you, in my opinion, why employers, like it's a lose-lose situation in most cases for employers to be involved in student loan payment assistance programs because employers are just not anticipating like changes to laws, changes to policies. And so I just think, gosh, this employer is spending hundreds of thousands of dollars per physician to get recruitment advantages when they could just be spending the money on lobbying to get their groups included in PSLF and then hiring expert help to get their employees, making sure they understand PSLF and getting it. This is a little frustrating because a lot of folks would say, well, shoot, I paid off my loans or refinanced my loans with the thought that a group like Kaiser would never become eligible. Some thoughts there is if you made that decision after March 13th, 2020, I would try to get a refund if you can on any payments you might have made on direct loans. You might ask for a full reinstatement of your loans if you refinance the whole thing. You know, I would at least try for that if you might be able to qualify for forgiveness. I'm anticipating that as this news gets out, a whole lot more groups like nurses, NPs, PAs, physicians in these states with these weird laws are going to reach out needing help as to what to do next. So if that's you, obviously book a call, studentloanplanner.com/book. Some thoughts now on the student loan lawsuits. So the main one that everybody's worried about is the GOP state lawsuits led by these state attorneys general. And the big question is do they have standing to block it? There was a letter that got released by Representative Cori Bush, who represents St. Louis, my old hometown. She basically asked the MOHELA leadership, are you involved in this lawsuit? Clarify your position. And the MOHELA leadership basically said, no, we're not involved in this lawsuit. We complied with the Sunshine Act request from the Attorney General as we were required to by law, but our position is that we want to not be involved in the lawsuit and just fulfill our contract with the Department of Ed. That's a big deal because MOHELA potentially having standing to sue or Missouri having the right to sue on behalf of MOHELA is really probably the biggest question in this lawsuit. If they can defeat MOHELA being a part of the lawsuit, then all the other arguments really seem tenuous at best. You have to say, well, the states are harmed by losing tax revenue. Well, I mean, you could make that argument with anything. You know, you could say that certain laws were passed that harm California's state income taxes at some point in the future, right? And then you could file a lawsuit on that. So it'd be kind of a Pandora's box to grant standing to states claiming they're harmed in state tax revenue by student loan cancellation. So I think the real question for this lawsuit is going to be, does a court think that the Missouri can sue on behalf of MOHELA since MOHELA has stated they don't want to be a part of the lawsuit directly in their own name? Another lawsuit that's not getting a lot of attention that's attacking the cancellation is one in a different court that's saying that the administration didn't follow the appropriate rulemaking process around cancellation and released this not according to the rules that are supposed to exist. You know, this is just my thought on these lawsuits. I think that the goal probably is to delay cancellation long enough until potentially if the House GOP wins the midterm election, then the House GOP probably definitely has standing to sue to block the student loan cancellation because they can argue, as House Democrats did when they tried to block President Trump's border wall spending, that the Congress didn't appropriate that money and therefore they have standing to sue to block it. If I was a Republican strategist trying to block student loan cancellation, what I would think that they would try to do is delay, delay, delay until you can get a party that definitely has standing, which is the House GOP and the majority. If the House GOP does lose the midterms, then they would not be able to do that, and then cancellation probably has got a lot better chance of going through. And then if cancellation does not go through, remember the Biden plan can pull that new IBR plan lever and be more aggressive if they want to be on that plan by like putting more time and effort into writing those rules in a super generous way. And so one of the things that I would probably tell people is when you do planning around, should I pin my hopes in this Biden IBR plan, you have to look at what you'd be eligible for if Republicans came in and took it away. So if Republicans came in and took it away, like, did you borrow after 2014? Are you a new borrower as of 2014? If so, you can fall back onto the new IBR plan, which is the same thing as the pay-as-you-earn plan. And that plan is statutory, which means that you would need 60 votes in the Senate to overturn that, which means it's never going to go anywhere. So if you model pay-as-you-earn /new IBR forgiveness and it still looks good for you to do that, then switching to the new IBR plan is a great idea because you should go for forgiveness no matter what if the numbers support it based off of you being able to have a fallback position of being on that new IBR plan. If, however, you are not a new borrower as of 2014, you don't qualify for new IBR. If you got onto the Biden plan, you need to know how the forgiveness strategies stack up with repay and pay and old IBR so that you know what your fallback position is if this were to ever get repealed, if not through executive action, but you know, if maybe by an act of Congress, right? And so these are some things we're going to bake into our analysis in the future, just sort of analyzing for people, you know, what do all the possibilities look like? And what does that mean for your long-term finances? It's not as simple as saying, oh, this is the plan with the cheapest payment. That's a good plan for like a year, but it's not a good plan for 20 years or 10 years. Some thoughts on the election that's happening today. If this, I think this podcast will come out on Tuesday, Election Day. Obviously, go vote. Take advantage of your right in our democracy to express your views. And if what I've been telling people is if the GOP wins the House, then I think higher chance that student loan relief gets blocked at some point. You'll see a lot of oversight kind of stuff. You'll see a lot of, you know, investigative hearings, subpoenas to Department of Ed. Department of Ed probably will try to not comply with as much as they can. You know, you might see stuff, a lot of just political gamesmanship in general, right? That typically happens when you've got different party control in the White House and in Congress. If the House is held by the Democrats, then, you know, you might see even more aggressive stuff happening in 2023 and 2024 with, you know, executive orders on student loans because the House GOP won't be able to stop it. It really kind of seems to me like the administration's strategy on student loans is, can somebody stop us because they can show a legal harm? And if no, let's do it and let's get more people relief, right? That's kind of the strategy. And so far, they've been very successful in that. Dip their toes in the water, right? Started off with some discharge of some, you know, for-profit schools, started off with some disability discharge, kind of like your low-hanging fruit. And then they went bigger and bigger and bigger to see when somebody was going to try to stop them. PSLF waiver, you started with that, said it was going to cost $2 billion, ended up costing maybe more like $15 billion, could have cost $140 billion if people had been aware of the opportunity, but they weren't. IDR waiver, then they announced that, but they put that on the back burner so they could release the student loan cancellation plan because that was something that they felt like they needed to do more quickly because of the potential GOP, you know, win in the House that could block them. So that's why they tried to rush to get that out first and prioritize the student loan cancellation plan first is because limited resources in Department of Ed, and they needed to go after that plan first in case that GOP would want to block that, which they knew that they would, right? And then once that is decided one way or the other, you have the new IBR plan. You have the IDR waiver, which they're talking about ending in July 2023. But some of the things that could happen after this election, what if the House GOP successfully goes after the emergency authorization, the Department of Health's emergency authorization for the COVID emergency? If you stop that, you could stop the IBR waiver. So you might see some efforts surrounding that. Again, you might see some efforts to block the cancellation. We're really in for a very volatile period. And if you go really hard in that new IBR plan, but it's not available until 2024, that means that folks have got to do a lot of work in the meantime, figuring out, should you recertify your income early? Should you change payment plans? Should you file separately when you haven't had to use your income tax return in several years? These are all questions that are going to keep our podcast pretty busy. So if you want to ask any of your own questions, go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail and ask your questions, particularly about any of these big changes that are going on with, you know, expanded PSLF, deferment and forbearance being eligible, the new IBR plan, and the potential of that being delayed, any questions about the lawsuits, any questions you have about getting and applying for student loan cancellation. We want to get all these answered. One more comment that's kind of interesting. On the IDR account adjustment page, we noticed that the Department of Ed deleted the language about how commercially held FFEL loans can get credit by consolidating. They just deleted that line, and we called it out on Twitter. We said, hey, this is extremely concerning. There was no notice given. You know, Department of Ed is not even responding to a lawsuit here. They're just proactively taking down commercially held FFEL loans from the page. Does this mean that they're now ineligible for the IDR waiver? And we created a little bit of a commentary on that on Twitter, and Department of Ed went back in and added back commercially held FFEL loans to the page. That's exciting. I don't know if that was just because of us, but there was enough confusion when they pulled that off that it looked like it was actually an inadvertent deletion versus an intentional deletion. And so it is clear that commercially held FFEL loans can benefit from the IDR waiver still. So definitely take advantage of consolidating. The only caveat to that is if you consolidate ineligible loans for the 10 and 20K cancellation with eligible loans, there is a current question mark as to whether or not you would that new consolidation load could be eligible for the 10 and 20K cancellation. So in the case that you're counting on that 20K cancellation, you might leave behind some direct loans that do definitely qualify when you're doing the consolidation to benefit from the IDR waiver. Honest to goodness, there's still massive amounts of ways to save money and pay for our consult fee 10x, 20x, even 100x. And so I hope you're still taking advantage of getting plans and follow-up plans if you feel like you need them with all the confusion going on. Ask the free questions on the podcast. We love those. Get that one-on-one plan if you need it. Studentloanplanner.com/book. Thank you so much for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. And remember to go vote today. And we'll have hopefully a lot to talk about on next week's show. Take care.